This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and letting us shoot here at your house.
No, thank you very much for coming here and welcome.
Thank you. I come from a certain generation of Vietnamese American. I was born here. I think that there is a, you know, I just wanted to start by saying that there's a big difference in, you know, perhaps the way we view the world, perhaps the way we view politics and everything. So I would love to have a conversation and we could be open about like certain ideas that you have.
100%. And I think the one guiding light for all of us is that we are original thinkers, right? I try to aspire to the fact that I try to approach issues and questions for what they are, and not because I am of a certain generation,
right,
of a certain political ideology. I don't think backwards. I don't think anybody who is a intelligent, thoughtful, and well-considered thinker would think backwards, because we try to think through the issues rather than backwards in I am X, therefore I think Y.
Right.
So I really welcome the opportunity to have a full and frank conversation.
I do like to go back into the past about your refugee experience, if we can start there.
Yeah.
What was it like? I know you came fully formed. You know, you weren't like a kid. You weren't a baby.
Well, you know, I was young. You know, I was 10 years old, and now having children who have passed that that age. You know, I do think that I was in the formative process. So I wasn't. I'm the youngest of seven children. So my older brothers and sisters are a little bit more formed than
right.
I was. But certainly, it was a formative experience for me. So my father was in a re-education camp after 1975. He was in the city council in the southern city of Vũng Tàu. And so he was put in a re-education camp. My mother and my older sister organized his escape from the camp the same day that our family escaped from the country. And because we were using our house as the debarkation point for the escape, it had to be simultaneous. Because if he escaped from the camp, they would arrest us. If we escaped from the country, then they would keep him in prison forever. And so it had to be simultaneous. And he lived as a fugitive with my sister's help for 5 years before he finally made it out in 1983. So meanwhile, in 1978, my mother took all of us and took us on the boat trip. It was a long boat trip. It was 12 days at sea. We had a small boat, probably about 15 meters or so, with 75 people on it. So it was standing room only. And so it was quite a harrowing experience, especially since we ran out of fuel and the engine broke. And so we were hungry and thirsty like so many other boat people, and until we got help from a Taiwanese fishing boat who gave us directions and compass and fuel to get to Malaysia. So it was quite a harrowing experience, and it really reiterated for me not only the lengths through which my family and my mom had gone to find freedom and opportunity, but how incredible that so many people have undertaken the same journey to seek freedom and as the price of opportunity, not just Vietnamese, but you know, refugees all over the world. And so it's it is a testament to the human spirit to live free and without oppression.
Yeah. When you got here at 11 or 12 years old, perhaps, what was going on in your mind in terms of the old country, new country, what you had to sort of do for the future? Did you think about any of that?
No, we were just trying to survive, right? We landed in Portland, Oregon on Thanksgiving weekend, and it was cold. I remember that. And so we had to get coats. You have to, you know, we had to get acclimated. We have to start thinking about learning English. My, we were sponsored by my aunt and uncle, and so we had, who arrived about 2 years before, and so they were trying to find their way as they were trying to help us find our way, and so literally just trying to survive, just trying to get acclimated, you know, after the weekend of reuniting with family. We started working literally on Sunday night, Monday morning to go clean restaurants, and my mom had to start taking driving lessons so that she can drive us to work. And so we, you know, there was not really a time for existential reflection. We were just literally trying to survive. Because remember, my father is still in Vietnam, living as a fugitive. My sister is helping him. And so we needed to find a way to get money back to them as quickly as possible so they can survive and they can join us.
And when you left Portland after 2 years, you came down to Orange County to live, correct?
Yeah, because you know, we were cleaning restaurants in Portland, Oregon, and during the summer we picked strawberries and other berries, which the mainstay of how we and other refugees were making money during the summer. And then Mount St. Helens erupted, if you recall, in 1980. So 2 years later, so therefore it really took away our ability to make a living. So we moved down to Orange County because my other cousins lived down here, and they said there is a thriving sewing and garment industry here, and so we were able to, you know, go and be job workers in the garment district.
And throughout high school, you was that in Orange County as well, right?
Yeah. So that was in Orange County, and my memory of junior high and high school up until about my junior year of high school was just working every single day after school. My mom would take us to the sewing shop, and we would work there until late at night, and then we would do it again during the weekends.
So you would go to school, and then at night you would go and work in the factory.
Yeah,
exactly. As a teenager.
Oh yes, you know, very young. We were 12 years old at the time. I was 12. My older brothers and sisters were there. But you know, it was a way to survive, right? We were very grateful for the opportunity to survive, to send money back to my father and my sister to help them escape. And I tell you, in 1983, my father finally made it out after 23 escape attempts. I remember the day when we came home, and my mom was shaking, crying, because she was holding a letter, and she couldn't describe it. You know, and so I looked at it. It was from my dad, and the return address was in the Philippines. So we knew exactly what that was. We all cried. We all celebrated. And then we put away the emotions and went to work. Because life goes on, right?
So yeah. And in high school, I understand that I think a debate coach had told you that you have the goods to apply to Harvard.
Well, I tell you, the story is a little bit more complicated than that. In freshman year of high school, I had to give an English class a very brief speech, how to do a certain thing. This is a way for the English teacher to acclimate us to public speaking. And I was so deadly shy. One, English is my second language. Two, I'm just a naturally shy person growing up. Three, this is the first experience I've ever had of having to do anything in public. That I literally could not deliver the speech, could not finish it. And I just ran out of the classroom in shame and all kinds of emotions. And so I remember, you know, facing up, as a freshman in high school, facing up to the challenge and then asking myself, you know, is this the way I'm going to live my life? You know, being debilitated by fear. And I said no. And the best way to cure that is to, you know, meet the fear head on. And so I approached a teacher He was also an English teacher, and he was very active in the local speaking and debating community. He was a speech coach at a prior high school. I knew that, and so I asked him, I told him the story, I asked him, is there a way that, you know, he can help me, one, cure the fear, and two, you know, maybe if I'm good enough to enter competitive speaking and debate. And he says, that's the only way to conquer your own demons. And it was great. And he's a great man, and he organized a little speech and debate team for about 5 or 10 of us. It was great. We went all around the state, all around the county. We went to nationals in order to do debate and speaking, public speaking. And I remember one time there was a tournament. It was probably my junior year of high school, when the coach told me that, hey, one of the judges want to make sure that you get his score sheet and his comments. Usually you don't, because the coach has to request it and all that's very complicated. But the coach finally, at the end of the day, gave me the comment sheet. And it was from, the judge was a local lawyer, I think he may have been a local judge, and said, if you put your mind to it, I think you'll become one of the great attorneys in this country. And, you know, obviously not true, obviously bombastic projection in order to encourage a young kid, but, you know, for a kid who's insecure, shy, you know, encountering a different world, not knowing the language that well, having learned it only a couple years before, it was a really good shot in the arm, right?
But there's got to be some signs that the coach, this judge, that they saw. Because you just don't make comments like that.
Well, you know, there is, you know, that one of the great gifts that this country has given me is are the mentors that I have been able to pick up along the way. And it starts with Mr. Reed, my speech coach, but it started even earlier, my seventh grade homeroom teacher, you know, who probably was the first and best influence in my early life when I went to junior high school. They all gave me the encouragement, they gave me the courage, and they gave me the confidence to try new things, to challenge my demons, and to have aspirations that go beyond what my vision would have enabled me to do at that time, and it was great, and you know, the ability to have role models and mentors who encouraged me along the way truly is probably one of the greatest gifts that this country and this community has given me.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak. I want to jump a little bit further ahead because this is kind of related to this topic. Is you were a professor at Georgetown Law for years, and when you look back on the stellar students that came through, what kind of things did you see, or could you perhaps maybe superficially predict that these were going to be? What are the things that you saw? And I think it's related back to what these mentors don't just take on anybody, right? What are the things that you think people see when they're taking on mentees? Or,
well, I know what I look for. People say, hyper smart, hyper motivated. I think those are all table stakes. At the level that of professional schools and of major law schools, you have to have demonstrated the ability to be intelligent, to be motivated. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to get in. And so, what I look for in addition is the kind kind of hunger that really truly is a deep motivator, and it has to come from within. I think external motivations are great, but they're fleeting. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what you look like. I think that having the God's given abilities and knowing what to do with it is a very important part of success. And I pick mentors and I pick mentees and stuff like that. Most of it is just happenstance, right?
Yeah.
People ask for my advice, and if I'm able to give it, I will give it very freely, because a lot of people have been generous to me.
Right.
There have been other stories. I remember when I decided to, on a lark, to apply to Ivy League schools, my high school guidance counselor just wouldn't write me the recommendation.
Oh, wow.
And he just said, nobody from this school has ever gone to an Ivy League school in this 100-year history. What makes you think you are going to be the first one? And I said, that's fair, but I have other people who encouraged me to reach for the stars. And so I went to talk to the principal, and I said, the guidance counselor has not written my letter. It officially comes from you, the principal's letter, and so will you write it? And she did, and gave me the recommendation, and I was fortunate enough to be admitted. And we didn't have money for me to go visit, and so I just threw up a coin between Harvard and Yale, and came up Harvard, and the rest is really the history of my life. And so I remember those feelings, both positive and negative, of detractors as well as mentors, and I just try to be the good guy rather than the other guy.
Yeah. And after law school, what was sort of like the direction that you wanted to take with the legal profession?
Well, I was very fortunate in the beginning of my second year to have landed a clerkship with probably the best judge in the country, period, to this day. He unfortunately passed away 2 years ago, Larry Silverman of the D.C. Circuit. He was a great mentor, great judge, and because he provides such great guidance, a lot of Supreme Court justices look to him for their clerks, because they know that, one, he hires great people, two, he really mentors them and teaches them during that 1 year of clerkship. So the clerkship is more graduate school for law, especially for litigators. And so that led in my third year to an interview with Justice O'Connor, who also gave me a clerkship. And Justice O'Connor, who just passed away a couple of months ago, is the other great mentor in my life, because not only did she give me the skills of being a lawyer, she was also, I would say, besides my parents and my wife, my biggest champion. She truly, just believed in me, really believed in all her clerks. And she was, she's a great advisor and mentor in that regard. Justice Silverman is, to this day, my closest counselor. None of us who clerk for Judge Silverman would ever make a major life decision, be it romantic, professional, or personal, without consulting the judge. And I'm fortunate enough to become friends with his son and his family. So now I get his advice through his family. But we all need those type of support systems people who believe in us and guide us through life.
Majority of my audiences are from 18 to 35 or 40, believe it or not. It's very young people. And so when I'm sitting across a guest like you, who've accomplished a lot, I have these questions for the young people. You function at the highest levels in the legal profession in your early years. What do all of these really spectacular lawyers, what in their minds, what do they all have in common?
Well, they call it problem-solving skills, but it's more than that. It's not just the skills, it's the passion. right? It's the desire to put your training and your skills to work in service of the profession and the community. We do that in private practice through advocating for and practicing what I call the system of democratic capitalism, the greatest system of organizing the economy and the government that we have ever seen, or I believe we'll see in human history. And every day is a journey. Every day is a contribution to that to the fundamental system that not only make us free, but give us the opportunity to be to achieve extraordinary things as Americans. And so I think recognizing the value of that work, of a lawyer's work, in providing the foundation for democratic capitalism is an essential part of how you contribute and how you achieve. Because you can think of lawyers' work, especially for young lawyers' work, as drudgery.
Yeah.
Right. You're just grinding briefs. You're looking at documents. You're looking at the you're deposing people. But it is the total result that really motivates you. I remember there's a fable that my grandfather, my great uncle really, but he was my grandfather because my dad was orphaned. But he's a Catholic priest. He tells me these fables when I was young, very young. And one of them stuck in my mind. It was like about a young man who comes upon a construction site and asked the construction worker, what is it that he's doing? He says, what does it look like? I'm digging a ditch. Mm-hmm. He goes to the second construction worker and says, well, what does it look like? I'm laying bricks. And somehow very accurate, but not entirely fulfilling. So he went to the third construction worker and says, excuse me, sir, what is it that you are doing? And the guy looked up and he says, isn't it obvious? I'm building a cathedral. I think the vision that redounds to the third person's benefit and to the detriment of the first two,
right,
is the ability to appreciate that what you do is not drudgery, but it is actually in service of some greater good. And for lawyers, it is providing the foundation for the system of democratic capitalism that underlies this entire country and our great economy.
I want to know about the journey to your position as an assistant attorney general to George W. Bush and how you got there and what was it like when you were there from 2001 to 2003?
When I came out of my clerkship, I spent a year working for the Senate Banking Committee, and then I went straight into academia. We attend this thing called a job talk. You go around talking to giving papers to faculty. I had a couple of draft papers. I gave them to various faculties around the country who were looking for young professors. I had an offer at Georgetown, which was my hometown. I love my colleagues there. So almost immediately, I felt very, very welcomed in the Georgetown Law Center community. And so I was a very young law professor, I think in my mid-20s, and I loved it. It was an opportunity to think deeply about the law. There's a luxury of interacting with people and being the good guy,
yeah,
and helping them along in their to start their careers. That really was a great motivator for me, and also it was very entrepreneurial. If you can think of academia as entrepreneurial, because we research whatever we want, we publish as best as we can, we develop a core group of students in order to motivate and inspire, and each one of us, succeed or fail on our own merits.
Right.
There's no bureaucracy. Nobody tells me what to research, how to write it, and all that stuff. So there's a great entrepreneurialism, which I found, very, very innovating. And so I just kept doing what I did. I wrote some Supreme Court briefs on the side, practiced mm-hmm. a little bit on the side for the consulting clients, but by the main, just putting my head down to get the tenure. And after I got tenure was also when the 2000 election happened. I was very, very interested in that moment in history. I actually wrote an amicus brief for Bush v. Gore at the Supreme Court, along with other colleagues, some of my best friends from law school. And it was just an amazing, amazing time. And it was, and I know Justice Breyer has talked about this, you know, it was the most contested election in American history at that time. And what happened? You didn't see tanks in the street. Right. You didn't see bloodshed. You know, you saw a peaceful transition of power, a very gracious speech by Vice President Gore, and a peaceful transition of power that really is the greatest testament to democracy, the Americans, and the American spirit. And it was just totally awe-inspiring to me. It was completely awe-inspiring. And so when, in the very short time that the president and his cabinet had in order to put together a government, because remember, this was, you know, late December, early January before we had a resolution, and transition happens on January 18th. Yeah. You got to get your act together to form a government. And I got a call from then Attorney General designate John Ashcroft asking me to come in for an interview. And he asked me, you know, am I interested in this position, that position, and the like? And I said, no, I'm really interested in this small little office called the Office of Legal Policy at the time, or Office of Policy Development. He says, well, that's the smallest function that we have. Why is that your request? And I said, you know, I'm an academic. I have, you know, three folders with me all the time, and mentally and also physically. One is the near finished draft folder that I'm right. preparing for publication. One is, you know, the half baked idea nothing, and then there's this little folder called the crazy ideas file. And, you know, it's part of my job and part of the way I think about life is let's think about, you know, what are some crazy ideas that I can turn into half-baked ideas, right. and then I can think and hopefully make them into fully formed thoughts and publishable quality. And John Ashcroft jumped out of his chair, walked across the office and said, Via, that's exactly what I'm looking for, because the art of leadership is the redefinition of the possible. I want you to come here and help me redefine the possible. And, you know, that just is very inspiring. You know, when the Attorney General is asking you to, you know, think through and help redefine the possible, you know, that's catnip to an academic, right? Mm-hmm. Or somebody who's a young and ambitious lawyer. And so, you know, that in itself is an act of mentorship, right? Giving me the mission, recognizing my desire to serve, but also the mission to do what I to help him with his leadership, and all of that became, you know, readily apparent and extraordinarily valuable after 9/11.
Yeah,
because, you know, literally the bombing of the World Trade Center, you know, it's kind of like throughout the rule book. You know, it's just the most devastating act of terrorism in American history on American soil. It was just, you know, it was just shock to all of us. And so we just have to rethink, you know, one, how lethal the enemy is, how different the methods are, and how we craft a response that is adequate to the task, while at the same time reaffirming and solidifying the foundation of democratic capitalism rather than chipping away or threatening that foundation, because that's what the terrorists were trying to do.
Yeah.
And so we didn't want to help them in their job in our response.
So you're probably asked to draft up and come together to put out the Patriot Act, right?
Yeah, it was a department wide effort, and then at later stage an administration wide effort. But I do remember being very clear, and the Attorney General being very clear with me, as the President was clear to the Attorney General, you know, get me the tools that is necessary to do this job. And one of the first and most fundamental questions that the Attorney General asked for me is the scoping question.
Yeah.
He said point blank, this is not Christmas in September. You know, do not throw in the kitchen sink. Give me the package of the most necessary powers and authorities, and the most and only that. And you have to ask the right questions so that we achieve the objective. And so we approached the hundreds, if not thousands, of ideas and mm-hmm. proposals that came into our little working group. With very straightforward questions that policymakers ask all the time. One, is this necessary in order to fight the war on terror? Two, give me examples of where the limits of the law or policy has been reached so that we can test the necessity of the issue. And then three, are there, you know, unintended consequences with this policy? And, you know, in many ways, the third question is the foundation of all the questions, which is this consistent with our American Constitution and values? And, you know, if there are ways to mitigate the unintended consequences, let's do it. And if those are too overwhelming or it threatens our constitutional order, then, you know, let's scrap it.
And then what resulted
was a package of 50 proposals that went to Congress. And I'm glad to say it was passed unanimously by the House and nearly unanimously by the Senate. And in record time, from beginning to end, it was a 6-week process.
Wow.
But it was a very concentrated process because there was no other game in town.
Yeah.
Everybody was focused
on that.
This mm-hmm. piece of legislation. Rarely, if ever, you have that kind of monomaniacal focus of all three, both houses and the executive branch on a piece of legislation. So even though temporally it was a short period, functionally it was
all hands on deck.
It was very, very concentrated and I think very democratic process.
Now, the context of when it all happened and putting that all together during that time, I'm sure you're right. You said everybody was on board with it. But looking back today, do you think that there are things that are in the Patriot Act that could be viewed differently today? You know, are there things in your mind that, like, maybe we didn't hit it enough or we went too far? Or?
Yeah. So there are a lot of things that people mistake the Patriot Act for. Because, you know, the Patriot Act was the piece of legislation that was passed by Congress and signed by the President, but it became a brand that expands to include, you know, total information awareness, mm-hmm. enemy detention, you know, all the other activities that were going on in the name of the war on terror, and so. The first recognition is that the Patriot Act was a very limited piece of legislation, 50 provisions, that essentially updated the law to the technology and helped us prosecute the war on terror, transformed the Department of Justice from a reactive prosecutorial agency into a proactive detection and prevention agency so that we can stop the next terrorist attack. And I'm glad to say that no court has ultimately invalidated any provision mm-hmm. that was passed as part of the USA Patriot Act as being unconstitutional, because we did our work very, very carefully and Congress did its work very carefully. But that said, we asked the exact same question, you know, in the period after 9/11, And we said, are there dangers here? Because we're essentially driving at night without the taillights to follow, yeah. Right? You're driving there and you're mm-hmm. kind of like, you know what you're trying to do, but you know, this is only the reach of your headlights.
Right.
There are no taillights and distance that you can follow because this is unprecedented in American history. And so Congress put in different provisions, for a handful of provisions, a sunset device, that it would sunset unless reauthorized within 3 years. And successively, it comes up every 3 years. Every single reauthorization has been passed by Congress. And so they ask these questions every single 3 years, and then after several cycles, they put in a permanent reauthorization. And so we put in the democratic process the checks and balances so that subsequent legislatures can re-ask the same questions that we were grappling with. And again, I think those provisions have stood up to the test of time, because we, as I said, this was not law enforcement Christmas in September.
Yeah.
And so, we did ask those questions, and Congress asked the questions, but consistently have reauthorized those provisions.
So up to today, all of those provisions, nothing has been pulled back or taken out?
No, they have been, there have been tweaks, and there have been amendments, there have been refinements and all that stuff. That's the democratic process. And
yeah.
And I think that's American government at its best.
Right,
100%.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
We learn through the common experience.
But that being said, there's still so much sentiment, you know, with the general public, people my generation, that the Patriot Act, it's taken, and I understand what you mean by the Constitution. You know, we all checked in with that, you know, your team, and even to today, it's all been, you know, voted in, and it's renewed every 3 years. But is it, you know, today where we are, you know, always, you know, my generation feels like it's so Big Brother, where we feel like we're in a different world
now.
Yeah,
then I think that I go back to the definitional issue.
Yeah.
Right? The Patriot Act has become a brand in politics in American society that's well beyond the provisions that Congress has authorized, passed unanimously, and reauthorized unanimously over the decades, right? And there's no better check than a bipartisan effort to pass and repass these kinds of legislation. And so what you are describing, which I do not doubt and indeed has observed, is not the Patriot Act as the Patriot Act, but the Patriot Act as the specter of post 9/11 responses, some of which have been invalidated as unconstitutional and overreach, and most of which have been retired because we're not in the space of immediate danger anymore. But it's also a brand, not just now, not just 9/11 responses, but really it's, you know, it's like Orwell in 1984. You know, it's just the specter,
right?
It's shortcut for a sentiment and a fear, which I think is genuine, but unfounded with respect to the Patriot Act itself. But as freedom-loving Americans, it's always good to be mindful of governmental overreach into our core liberties. You know, and you don't need George Orwell to remind us of it. In fiction, throughout history, we've seen governmental overreach whenever there were opportunities or perceived threats in our society. And, you know, frankly, we as freedom-loving Americans should always be a little bit wary.
Yeah.
We all should be, at our core, libertarians, because that's what made this country great, and that's what the Constitution at its core protects. And so, you know, unfounded or not, I think it's a good question to have, and a good fear to keep in the back of our minds.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese-American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
Yeah. I want to go back to that transition, the peaceful transition of power that you mentioned during the election cycle with Bush and Gore. And when we take it back to our January 6th and what was going on just recently with Trump, what was your thoughts on that? Did it chip away at sort of like the belief internationally in our sort of way we do democracy?
I think January 6th, 2021 was, in my mind, the nadir of the American spirit. It is the absolute lowest point in our constitutional democracy. In many ways, it is more offensive to my constitutional belief in democratic capitalism than even a foreign terrorist attack. Because this is domestic, this is from our own people, you know, defeating our biggest symbol of American government. I'm not saying this in order to ascribe blame or to enter the political debate. But just the mere fact of seeing our capital being overrun, our police officers being killed, and you know, our public officials vilified for doing their constitutional duty, was very, very dispiriting for me, and as I think for a lot of Americans, and so we should always guard against that. Now, you know, it's the work of a few that hopefully offends the many, and also reminds us of how fragile our constitutional democracy is. And so, again, we should always be a little bit libertarian, a little bit wary of governmental power, and know that you know, that which we have here, that this system of democratic capitalism is very fragile, and it requires a lot of care and feeding.
This might be a funny question to ask, but I'm sure you saw the three-striped flag on the day of January 6th. Did that give you any feelings or emotions when you saw the old flag, our Vietnam's old flag?
Yeah, but you know, as I do, you know, when I see it normally, I did not, to be perfectly honest, you know, place any significance to it on January 6th, because January 6th is just such an overwhelming, you know, the event that it kind of it kind of overrides and overwhelms all other feelings and sentiments in my part.
And so after your work with the being assistant attorney general, how did you begin to work your way to the Fox News family?
Well, you know, I returned to my faculty position. But before I left for the Department of Justice, I was tenured, and I had a 2-year leave of absence in order to serve in government. That 2-year came up in May of 2003, and so I returned to the faculty, you know, the home that I loved, again, as I did before, I started a little consulting firm that, through various iterations, grew into a very successful, because the work of my partners and colleagues, a very successful Supreme Court and high-stakes litigation boutique. We only had 20 lawyers, but I think we punched above our weight. And it was very, very, it was such a wonderful experience. We ultimately was acquired by a great law firm, Kirkland & Ellis, and we joined, you know, a very big international law firm. And throughout this period, I had sat on corporate boards. Rupert Murdoch asked me to consider joining this company. We couldn't make it work because I love academia. And so he and the board invited me to join the board of the News Corporation at the time. This was in 2004 when I was about, 36 or so. And Rupert is just magnificent. He, he's a very, very good leader and a wonderful identifier of talent and a great manager of talent in the sense that he will provide the vision, but he would also encourage the executives to do their work. So I've been on the board of the News Corporation for a number of years, for 15 years, by the time that Rupert sold 2/3 of the company to Disney Company, and Lachlan Murdoch, his son, became chief executive officer of the new Fox Corporation. And Lachlan asked me to come and be part of the new company, not as an independent director, but rather as a operational executive. And I jumped at the opportunity for several reasons. One, my mom passed away the year before, and so I had a real desire to come back to Southern California, be close to my family, close to my father. Two, this was an opportunity to work with people I've known through my entire professional life over several decades, people I knew and trust and enjoy spending time with. And then three, we were able to, as Lachlan put it, start with a blank sheet of paper in order to identify the work that we will do, the industries that we will work in, but most important, the people we're going to work with. And so it's a very, very exciting opportunity to join Rupert and Lachlan and my colleagues in helping build the new Fox.
So today, there's so much polarization in the mainstream media, and there's just so many extremes.
Yep.
And it's both the left and the right. It's deteriorating the way we get along with each other, the way we have discourse in this country. Do you have any thoughts on if this is going to get better?
Let's step back a little bit and talk not just about the media, but about society and the polity.
Yeah.
I remember one time after I came out of government, this was around 2006 or so, my next door neighbor at Georgetown is John Podesta, the chief of staff to President Clinton. Just a wonderful, wonderful person, great colleague, good thinker. We obviously disagree fundamentally on a number of political issues, but we're good friends, and as all thoughtful human beings, we are honest with each other. I remember we were on a panel together at Georgetown, and both of us kind of recognized, even then, that we're entering probably the most populist phase of American politics that we in our lifetime have never seen. I would argue that has accelerated to the present day, that overrides and overshadows even the last most populist wave, which is the Jacksonian era in the mid-1800s. And so there is this devolution of dialogue into what I call base politics, largely because of a number of societal, political, international, and economic pressures that really drives the polity into different camps, and I think part of it is how closely divided we are. Remember, Bush v. Gore was essentially a 50-50 tie. Yeah. Many of our elections are unpredictable. I think the 2016 election was like that. The whole country is very evenly tied, And when you're, you know, when you're that evenly tied, you know, you tend to, you know, you tend to, you know, to, the contest gets a little bit more competitive.
Right.
Right. It's just like any close game. And so people, you know, compete more vigorously, which is part of the
process,
beauty of democracy. Yeah. And so I think part of that is just innate, but also gives me hope, because at the end of the day, we're very close together. The rhetoric has gotten very hard because, you know, the contest has gotten much more competitive. But, you know, we're very, you know, we're close together numerically. We're at the, you know, we're at that kind of like, you know, equipoise in American society. And I think the media in general, not just TV media, but also print media and social media. Is just, you know, it's just a mechanism to, you know, to amplify the most extreme of those views.
Yeah, because you hear about these stories of the John Podestas and the Viet Dins, you know, very different, you know, viewpoints being close. Mm-hmm. But every day when there's this sort of this media perception of this polarization, it's somehow feeling like the fabric of society, American society, is being deteriorating and it's being destroyed.
Yeah, you know, I tell you, I'm much more optimistic than that.
Yeah.
I think the American spirit is fair. It is even keeled. And so I see the loud and extreme voices as really the current version of the internet trolls of the last the decade or so, that, you know, they want, because the American spirit is even keeled and sensible, but, and you know, cursed toward justice. I think, you know, the extreme voices seeking to be demagogues have to become more extreme and more shrill. I hope that at some point people will recognize that, you know, the detriment that brings, and our policy would become more civil. But, you know, and that's because I am an eternal optimist. You know, I see in it part of the technological disaggregation, if you will, of viewpoints, so that, you know, there are not dominant institutions that, you know, that controls American thought or American life. To me, that is a cause for celebration, because you know, now you have the disaggregation of power, and it allows for individuals to have the capability to affect public debate. It's, you know, it's very messy.
Yeah, Simone, it's super messy. Yeah,
Simone Bolivar made the observation, you know, a century ago, that, you know, that democracy is very messy. Yeah. And he argued that it was not the best way, the best form of government, because it's so messy. But I happen to go the other way and say, you know, democracy is the best form of government, especially because it's messy.
Right. But you have to say that we, whether it's CNN or Fox, that there's this... I would say both of them are very guilty of really kind of stretching these points to play the media game to get viewership or whatever that is.
Yeah, it's you know, first of all, CNN is about 1/10 the audience of Fox, and so in many ways, you know, it's all of the mainstream media, you know, standing up to the center right, Fox News, but it's not any particular institution, it's not any particular company. I think it's just a recognition that the now, through technological and editorial advances, we have now empowered the people again to speak up and again, you know, that comes with messiness.
Yeah.
I think the advantage of something like Fox was the recognition that Rupert made and Roger Ailes made, that there is a vast middle America that's being underserved by the coasts, literally, you know, geographically, and also certainly metaphorically, whereby both the news and the entertainment culture was being dictated by coastal elites,
right,
and all of middle America was underserved. And that is not only a great political opportunity to speak to the people who make up the majority of our democracy, but also a great economic opportunity.
Right.
You know, there is a huge market there that has not been fully served. That's why, you know, Fox News, despite all of the detractors, has been the number one news network and the number one cable network for the last 20 years. You know, and so there is a sense that, from as I said, you know, it is very liberating, even with all the messiness.
Right, right. Now, there has to have been moments in your 20 years with News Corporation, Fox family, that you go, that probably doesn't sound right. You know,
as I do with any at any time, not just news and not just Fox. You know, where as I say, I don't think in reverse. And so I think in forward, and so it's not just, it's not news, not Fox, it's not, you know, because it doesn't define who I am, but every, you know, anywhere in our society.
But are you, you know, open to, were you, you know, ever at the point where you're like, I step up and speak up about like that or that issue?
You know, that's a freedom and an obligation we all have as human beings, not just as executives, because, you know, we are hired and paid very handsomely in order to do our jobs faithfully. And it's not, you know, again, you know, I am I'm a lawyer, and hopefully I am an effective leader. And part of that obligation is to speak your mind.
Yeah. So, yeah. And you're really close to the Murdoch family, but you know, I want to talk about business and family, you know, relationships, because it's almost like your family to Lachlan, to his son. And when there's business decisions that are in opposition to sort of the family, like, did that put you in a hard spot?
No, now you're talking about succession.
I've never watched it, but
I hear it's a pretty good piece of fiction.
Yeah, I haven't watched it.
But it's just... No, we're professionals.
Yeah.
And Lachlan is a great leader, and Rupert is, you know, our great founder and leader. So you know, it is I would say that the fact that we have a family control of a public corporation is a bonus, especially in the media space, where long-term vision and editorial direction is important, and that's why you see, you know, the great media companies are essentially controlled by families. You see the Sulzberger of New York Times. You saw, you know, the Grahams of the Washington Post. You see the Roberts at Comcast. You know, and all of these things, because it requires a long term vision and consistency.
Yeah.
And I think it's been, you know, Rupert and Lachlan's stewardship of the company and their leadership in the industry is unparalleled. So,
what makes you think, or what has given them that sort of experience to lead? What do you think in the formation, in their water that they were drinking growing up, that made them good leaders?
Yeah, look at Rupert is the greatest founder, one of the greatest founders, certainly, of the last century. I mean, he's a great builder. He's a great thinker. He's a curious thinker, and, you know, and he has the courage of his convictions, and that ultimately brings the success not only to him and his family, but also, I would argue, to the whole corporate enterprise, as well as the societies that he has operated in. You know, we just remember the arc of the end of the 20th century with the fall of communism, you know, the leadership of Reagan and Thatcher, you know, the post-Cold War development of the world, and it's just incredible how much history has happened in the last 50 years, and that kind of dramatic historical change, I think, requires clear vision, consistency of leadership, and a dogged determination in believing in what you do and the good that you serve. And you know, Rupert really is the embodiment of all of that.
Yeah. So. As I'm sitting here hearing your stories, I understand that you were not, I mean, now I understand all of the time that you spent in government and academia and at Fox, we haven't, as a community, Vietnamese, I haven't seen much of you. And, you know, that's why I wanted to engage in conversation with you, because probably from now to the end of our conversation, I really do want to talk about the Vietnamese community, yep, both the diaspora and in Vietnam.
But the reason we haven't heard much from me is I'm a lawyer, and I like to keep give my advice to my clients and the people I serve. And so, you know, rather than, you know, when I was an academic, or when I was in government, it was my job and my duty to explain what we do, or to impart knowledge about the law. But as a lawyer and as an executive, you know, I see my role as keeping my mouth shut and and put my head down and do the job.
But so thank you so much for being here with me. But I do want to see more of you in our community. I know you're very close to Kuching, and you know, we don't have very many Vietnamese at your level. And you know, are you going to kind of partake more in the upcoming years within our community? And how could you, you know?
Of course, you know, I am a Vietnamese American, and I talk about that identity with my children, who also are curious and developing their own identity. I've never thought of myself but part of the Vietnamese community. Speaking of Go Kyu Jin, let me tell you the story how we met.
Yeah.
I was a junior or senior in high school. I got an invitation to the Vietnam Education Scholarship Foundation or something like that. Turns out it was Kyu Jin's foundation, and she gave out scholarships in order for Vietnamese American students to attend college. And it was not much; it was like a couple of $1,000. But you know, at the time, it was momentous.
Yeah.
It was a lot. It allowed me to be able to fly back during vacation time to go to visit my family. It allowed me to have some extra pocket money to be in Cambridge, and most importantly, it was a tangible gesture of somebody's belief in me. And Go Kyu Jin, you know, then and now, you know, is, you know, the most famous actress that we have, and you know, her gesture of reaching out and giving me that shot in the arm really was, you know, is one of those things that remains with me. You know, so as I said, my great privilege has been to be able to pick up mentors and champions throughout my life, and Go Kyu Jin is one of those. But yes, of course, you know, I think the Vietnamese community is thriving. I think it's a wonderful tribute to our Vietnamese experience. And part of the experience is that we see Vietnamese in every single walk of life, and we don't think anything of it, right? And so you know, and it's becoming, success has become normalized, but at the same time, we should not take it for granted.
Right. Well, yeah, going back to this idea where Kyu Jing is still, you know, she's in the community, and, you know, you guys, she had a profound influence on the help that she gave you at that time. You know, as a friend to you now, somebody who, you know, I want to get to know more of you and be around, but also I'm at a place where I want to have more Viet Dinh of the world in the Vietnamese community be part of the growth of, because although we think that we have done a lot, you have done a lot, and there's very few of you at that level in our community. And I think that there's this sort of thirst to get sort of this involvement from you. And
yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I've always,
and forgive me for getting this,
not at all. And I think it's an important and very, very important reminder to us all that we all do what we can, and we all do what needs to be done in order to provide inspiration and leadership for the next generation. Because for all the people who, you know, who reached out and gave me a helping hand, I feel the same obligation. But it's not duty, it's not obligation.
Right.
It is as inspiring for the mentors as it is for the mentees.
And
I think that those in public service think of service as a gift and as a wonderful opportunity for personal fulfillment. So I agree with you, and we shouldn't do it just out of obligation or duty, but we should do it out of joy.
Yeah, but I could see it from both perspectives, because probably somebody like you would probably be like, well, I have to help everybody, right? Because America does need help in many different ways from a higher level. But at the same time, I wonder if the Vietnamese community, from your perspective, needs your help, needs your assistance, needs your guidance.
I wouldn't put it that way, because I think the Vietnamese community is thriving and has some wonderful leaders and contributors and the like. I would put it from a more personal perspective. I identify as Vietnamese. I always think of myself as as Vietnamese, and so my participation in contributions to that community is really part of who I am. It's not an obligation, because it comes from the heart. It comes from who I am, rather who I need to be. And so in that sense, it brings me joy.
Yeah.
Period. Yep.
Do you see a future of your life working in Vietnam, working with Vietnam, working with the new country, basically?
Well, my son, Alexander, is returning to Vietnam this summer for his first time in order to do an internship. Our mutual friend Henry Nguyen is one of the lights of our community. You know, he's that day. I was very proud to find out that he is the owner of LAFC,
FC, yeah.
Which is a great football club. The new enhanced trade status in Vietnam, I think, gives a lot of opportunity for Vietnamese, both in Vietnam and here, to help both America to keep her critical supply chain open, and also to introduce Vietnam to the wider world. So,
and as a lawyer, how much further does Vietnam need to go with their sort of legal structures, whether it's in entertainment law or criminal law, or, you know, how much further are we looking at here?
I firmly believe in a system of laws defined as the wise restraints that set men free, right? The more consistent and the more predictable our rule of law is, the more it allows society to flourish, because people can have ordered expectations. They know how contracts are enforced. They know what activities are legal or illegal. And so the more certainty, consistency, and predictability our system of laws, any country, the more it empowers human activity and achievement. And that's not just Vietnam. It's not just America, but I think it's around the world. And I think as a lawyer, I firmly believe in the rule of law, and not just as a way to govern ourselves, but in many ways a way to empower human progress.
You have a long life left. You have many years left. What do you want to do with the remaining? With your time on Earth?
You know, I tell you, I want to return to the opening thesis that we started talking about, which is, I, as a 10-year-old boy, was led by my mom and my family to go searching for a better life, a freer life, the system of democratic capitalism that this country has given me. And I think that it is a fragile thing, as I say, that we should not take for granted. And I want to end the second half of my life the way I tried to live the first half of my life, which is to be consistent to those principles and to uphold and advocate for that system of democratic capitalism that has given me and my family so much, that we need to preserve for eternity. So,
Viet, thank you so much for your time today and opening up your doors to your house. And I look forward to seeing more of you, not only within my friend circle, but in the greater community, the Vietnamese community.
You will. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Viet.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.